Application number 14989, Gene Roundtree, Reel 1.
I was born in a lovely country house in Yorkshire. We had our own farm. I had my own governess there. And it was, I think, a very privileged background. But at the same time, it was a Quaker background, and we were all brought up in a sense of responsibility. I went to a Quaker school. Mount School, York, and most of our immediate neighbours were Quakers, because it was a world before the motor car when I was a child, and the people one knew were the people within driving or walking distance on the whole.
Do you remember anything at all about World War
I? Oh yes, indeed, because that's a long story. I was in, we were crossing Germany when the war started, and we got stuck in Switzerland and had to be got out with difficulty. The people were stuck in Switzerland by the British consul, who was rounding up everyone he could before the Germans got to Paris, which they're very near. We heard the guns and they cut the lines behind us. My mother had gone out to pick up my eldest sister, who had been on a holiday there, and she didn't feel she could leave her, but she went out very near the outbreak of the war.
Did the war affect your family at all? You know, the young men, for instance?
Oh, it affected my only brother, who had been at a Quaker school. His friends were Quakers, and he naturally, without a very great deal of thought, went in the Friends Ambulance Unit. Rather than the army, he was at Cambridge. He'd passed his first MB and was going to be a doctor. But
what was his name?
Laurie. And he, when the first part of the ambulance unit in Flanders, the first year, was over, things changed, and he was sent to a military hospital in England, in York actually, which is very much his own home ground, and he came to the conclusion that he didn't have strong enough principles to avoid taking part in a war that he knew quite a bit about, because he'd been seeing life in the trenches. So he enlisted. He drove one of the first tanks, the Battle of the Somme. He was given a commission. He was wounded. He was given a commission. And he was killed at Passchendaele in 1917. So that was the background of the war for me.
Could you tell me something, you know, having gone to the Mount? Were you expecting a sort of higher education?
Well, it was a little difficult, because I wanted to be a doctor, partly because I wanted to follow my brother, but I had very bad septicemia once or twice, and I was told it wouldn't be wise. So then I went in for my second interest, which has always been history, and I went to Oxford to read history.
Sort of interwar period, and the build-up, you're going to France to Prague, rather, in 1938. When did you become aware that there might be another sort of threat in Europe with the rise of Hitler?
Oh, I think very early, because one of the things I was doing after I left Oxford was lecturing to the WEA on international affairs. I had cousins in that part of Czechoslovakia. It was lately finally taken over, and went to see them, and one saw what was going on in Nazi Germany. I became aware of it way back about 1930.
When did you feel you wanted to do something to help sort of people who were trying to get out?
Rather late, I think, because I think the knowledge of what was happening to them didn't seep through to England as early as it should have done. I should say that the first time I wanted to do anything of that sort was perhaps 1935, when I was having a sabbatical term and went to the Quaker Center in Vienna to look after people who had been involved in the attack on the socialist flats earlier that year. And we were just giving relief. I mean, we were not, I think at that point, doing much in the way of emigration. I think that came a little later.
Did you have any contacts with Germany? Family contacts or other?
Only with our relations in the Sudetenland. But I hadn't seen them or met them until I went to stay there in 1935.
So what was it that inspired you to actually go to Czechoslovakia in 1938?
Well, I was having a term off. I've had some medical trouble and wanted to pick up from it. And I was also wanting to get more first-hand material for my WEA lectures, and I was proposing to go back to Vienna. But my cousin Tessa, who had gone out to Prague after Munich, sent for me and said, could I come there instead? Because there were a group of people beginning to do various things like make lists of people who wanted to emigrate and what qualifications they had, and also to get supplies to the people who were stranded in the camps that they'd taken refuge in after Munich. So Tessa sent for me, and I went out, I think at the end of October. It might have been just the beginning of November, I haven't got the date. And I had a very curious journey getting into Prague, but I finally did land there in the middle of the night and joined up with one or two people who had already taken over a flat belonging to a friend of Benish, a journalist called Ripka. He'd emigrated. And we stayed at the flat, which he'd left very hastily. The windows were all covered up with things to prevent the glass disintegrating if Prague had been bombarded. And there were very handsome gas masks hanging on the umbrella stem, much better than the ones we had in England later.
It's interesting, your journey into Prague, did you see any evidence then of preparations for war? Were there any sort of gun emplacements or...?
Hardly anything. Just on one point of the frontier, I think.
Was there any sort of real organisation, with this group of people?
Well, perhaps I ought to say a word about the group of people I found there, who supplied me with Ovaltine in the middle of the night and gave me a bed in a strange room in the flat full of cactuses that somebody had been collecting. There were the important person was Doreen Wadena. She, like me, had been at Somerville reading history. She had gone on to, I think, specialising in economic developments in post-war Europe, and was a member of the School of Slavonic Studies. Had no definite object, she said, in going there in the first place. Her only connection was a vague commission for the Save the Children Fund, which had given her £150 for relief work, and a ready-made telegram to send to, on arrival, thousands of starving children pouring into Prague, urgent appeal necessary. And she thought the intention was to organise soup kitchens like those in Vienna after the war, but she found it was very different. She got there on October the 13th, and she's written an account of her work there, which is available, I think, at the School of Slavonic Studies. She very soon saw that there were two things that got to be done. One was to provide means of livelihood and necessary human background to the people who had got out of the Sudetenland after Munich but had not yet been allowed into Czechoslovakia. They were in camps, some of them were disused sugar factories, and camps where people had come to work in the season, which were empty for the other part of the year. It was rather desolate places. They needed warm clothes, they needed help in getting to a stage of thinking that they could leave the country and had something to offer elsewhere. They needed, later on, employment. They wanted to learn languages. And they needed sort of human background of life. The women wanted to knit. The men wanted to play chess. They wanted, above all, to prepare themselves for leaving the country. And I remember they had wonderful timetables. They had one period for cultural discussion and one for language learning and one for doing all the household chores, one for making furniture. Well, those were the camps. As well as that, we set up an office in our flat in Prague for people who were in danger and who wanted to be emigrated. And Doreen must have been responsible for getting hundreds of thousands of people out, a lot of them to South America, a lot of them to Canada, and small quantities of them to England and the United States.
Would they mainly have been Jewish?
Not only, I think the people who came to our flat did tend to be mainly Jewish, but the people in the camps were very often just simply social democrats who were politically in danger.
What was the Czech government doing with these people?
Precious little. I think they were in a poor, in a state of shock. They were very cooperative in helping us to help the camps, but they weren't in fact themselves sending any people out.
This would have been, as you say, the time of Benish, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, after Benish. I think the government is in the hands of somebody called General Serovi. And it is a world that lives rather on visiting cards. I mean, if you wanted to get anywhere, you had to have a visiting card. And I remember Doreen, who would use any means that she could with a great sense of humour, once saw Serovi's card on a table, and her hand hovered over it. She thought she wanted to steal it because what she could do with it. In the end, she decided she wouldn't steal that one. I think she stole something else.
That doesn't sound very Quakerly.
Oh, Doreen was not a Quaker.
Wasn't she?
No.
You were saying the team and how important she was. Who else was there?
It was hardly a team. There was my cousin Tessa. There was Philip Noelbaker's sister, Mary Penman, who was very useful to us because she had been in Yugoslavia after the First War and spoke Yugoslav, which was near enough to Czech, for the Czechs to understand it, if they didn't speak German. But of course our problem was a lot of them could speak German, they wouldn't, because of the things that had been happening. And what we had to do was to speak English, and then they would let us speak German. But it was useful to have somebody who could speak something near a Czech. I learned a few words in Czech, I had to. They've all gone, because one has no language background to place them in. But I do still remember that I had to go to the Prague version of Woolworths to buy gents' underwear when it was getting cold. I think 1,000 pairs of Pansky Panty. As well as Doreen, we had working with us, but not living in the flat, David Wills, who was the financial editor of the News Chronicle, which had collected a fund for helping refugees. We had a lot of little funds, a little fund from the Quakers, Doreen's little fund from the Save the Children Fund. We didn't have a great deal of money, but we made it go quite a long way. And also, we did have the help from time to time of people who came out and were prepared to do what Doreen suggested was useful to do. One of them was Alec Dixon, the founder of the voluntary service overseas, who had a military pass and could get into places where other people couldn't.
Did you have any idea, you know, at this time what the Czech people thought of Neville Chamberlain? As you say, it was after Munich.
Well, what the educated thought, the sort of the people who came to our Prague office thought was that he couldn't have been so stupid as that. He must have had something else up his sleeve. The people in the camps, I think, just were rather down on the whole Munich agreement and everyone who was connected with it.
What did you yourself think about the policy of appeasement and what happened
Munich? Oh, totally against. I mean, we were appalled by the relief we experienced when we didn't have to go to war, but we felt guilty at having accepted it. I think that's partly why some of us went out there, a feeling of working off our guilt by doing something in this quite small way to help the people who had suffered from the agreement that led us out of war.
Your own job, what actually were you doing? Can you think of a sort of time in 38 and a sort of typical week, what you would have been doing at that time?
Well, it was, every day was different. The sort of thing was that Tessa and I used to go out together sometimes to the camps to find out what they needed, to take out things they needed. Things I've mentioned, like things like wool for the women to knit warm clothes to get for the winter, and also to take details as far as we could of people who wanted to be emigrated and what possible qualifications they had for doing that. We'd take this car, Noah Baker's car, which one of us drove, and go into the outlying parts of Czechoslovakia, Moldavia. We went once to a castle which was owned by a very wealthy family called Moravets, who had given up half the castle to refugees and were helping us wherever they could. And we used to go out there, and it is a curious world, and be greeted by the gardener of the Moravets' half of the castle with beautiful bunches of violets, and taken in to a very simple lunch of homemade soup, and talked to the owners of the castle. And then we'd go to the other part where there were hundreds of people staying. They're very optimistic, on the whole, having enough to live on. And one day we arrived there. There'd just been a marriage between two of the refugees, and there was a minor celebration going on. They kept up their spirits, and life went on with them. And in the end, of course, an awful lot of that particular castle load, I think, went to Canada.
Yes, they seem to be a very resilient sort of people, the Sudetans, from what you're saying.
Well, in a funny way, yes, in a funny way, no. I mean, they would, the pure Czechs rather than the German Czechs, would fling themselves on their bed and say, what's the good? But the German Czechs, the pure Sudetans, were very much more optimistic and enterprising.
How successful were you in being able to get them out of the country?
I think through the Czech committee in London, we must have got thousands of people out.
The other end to sort of vouch for them?
Oh, yes, there was a Czech committee to do that. That wasn't a Quaker thing. That was, I think the News Chronicle was partly responsible for that. I forget at the moment who was on it, but I think they were people connected with the government.
Did you ever yourself have to take people out, you know, across borders?
No, Tessa did that. The nearest I got to that was seeing people onto the train across Poland. And from ordinarily in the Prague station. But one day I remember doing that, and we had to supply them with their cash and all their credentials. And it was when we were having a handover, because I had to go back, Christmas time, and to a job. And we had a very good Unitarian lady coming out, middle-aged to elderly. She belonged to the generation that had its money in a bag under the skirt. And she happened to have all our loose money that day. And when we got down to, we hadn't handed over before, when we handed over the station, up came her skirt, out came the bag, and everyone leant out of the train and received their quota of it. No, Tessa took people actually across the Polish corridor, but that was before I came.
Jewish people who were trying to get out? Were there particular problems there?
I think the Jewish people were so frightened. A lot of them had come from Germany to Austria and then from Austria to Czechoslovakia. And they knew that there were papers that the Nazis had. And they were naturally terrified. And they were a little difficult because they wouldn't tell us that they were trying other sources as well as ours, which did make problems at the other end. But the people we got out were immensely grateful. I mean, it's one of the characteristics of the Jews, I think, that they never forget a friend. And when I was back in England and back at the BBC, I sometimes went to lunch at a little restaurant nearby, which I thought was kept by Austrians. And one day there'd been something about me in the Times with a photograph, and the restaurant owner looked at me very hard, and he said, "You're Miss Rowntree." I said, "Yes." He said, "You saved my life, you got me out." And he would never let me pay for my meal after that. I had to stop going, it was too embarrassing. They were immensely grateful, and they were very grateful too in Czechoslovakia itself, in Prague, in trying to provide us with a social life. So to make it easier for us to carry on the other life that we were living. They took us to concerts, they had parties in the evening, they introduced us to their own sculptors and musicians, and there was a sculptor who took me around. He was he taught at the Prague University and was specially interested in Baroque art. And he took me around all the Baroque churches of Prague, of which there were a great many, on the coldest day of the year when I had the worst cold I've ever had. And I would have enjoyed it in normal circumstances. But that's the kind thing they did for us.
What was Prague like then, the sort of atmosphere in Prague? Well, it's a beautiful city, isn't it?
It's one of the most beautiful cities I know. It is very strange because there was this feeling of something coming to them. And people committed suicide in the Prague tradition, which was throwing themselves out of windows. Several people did that while I was there. People came to see us who had been branded with swastikas. And to set against that, there was the opera, there were concerts, there were people going about their ordinary business. There were good restaurants with people going there with seagoing bands playing to them. It was two worlds.
I could imagine, the work you were doing. Did you find it quite a strain at times,
Oh, there were times when our sense of compassion simply dried up. You couldn't take any more. When we listening to stories in the office of what had happened to them, you had to ration yourself because you couldn't do more than a certain amount of that a day. But then, in a funny way, one picked up again, I think partly because of the kindness and the help of our Czech friends.
Was there much of a German presence in Czechoslovakia then?
Oh, no. In the later stages of Tessa's work, after the Germans had walked in, of course, there was a certain I don't know how to put it. There was an awareness of what the Germans were doing, and there were contacts in which the Germans came and told us all about what wonderful labour camps they had. And we had one person who'd come out from England to help us, who was rather won over by that and became rather a danger. But in the early days, no Germans at all, no. No German spoken if you could help it. We felt, in a way, even in our early days, whether the English were so ill thought of that we almost wanted to cover up our GB on the car. Mm.
Yes, did you ever experience any hostility?
No, never. Never. Nothing but kindness. I mean, I think by that time they knew we were there to help. They did everything they could for us, and when I wanted to go and get details of some especially endangered people who had got into no man's land after the Munich settlement and were living in caravans on what the Jews could bring them round after dark. I was helped very much to go out there by a Jewish family. He was, in fact, a diplomat working for, I think, for some South American country, so he had diplomatic.